515-995-9999. The LSB is looking forward to sharing with you how the station, which has been navigating the challenges posed by COVID, will navigate into the future again. That's Wednesday, August 11th at 7 p.m. Hope to see you there.
The previous program was the WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio coming up. It is 6:30.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency. Today, we're bringing you a perspective on climate crisis news that you might not hear in mainstream media. In fact, you won't. Last week, this program interviewed Dr. Segun Henry of MIT about his proposed solution to the challenge of intermittency in renewable energy generation, which he calls the, quote, sun in a box, end quote, concept. This is a plan to store excess heat within large containers filled with liquid metal so that the energy will be available to the power grid at times when solar panels or wind turbines can't produce energy on their own. In this way, burning fossil fuels could no longer be justified. Now, as it happens, there has been quite a bit of news recently on the topic of energy storage. For example, a New York Times article last month was titled, "Energy Department Targets Vastly Cheaper Batteries to Clean Up the Grid." Note the emphasis on the word cheaper, not better, or more effective, or more efficient. As is so often the case with mainstream media, articles about possible strategies for dealing with the climate crisis, the bottom line is, well, the bottom line is financially. It's a financial issue. Apparently, the future of mankind will depend on whether the manufacturer of the right energy storage system can make a decent profit on its product. Now, this is not a minor objection. If we wait for these new technologies to be cheap enough for us to use economically, we may very well be lost as a species. For example, the energy from lithium-ion batteries now costs $137 per kilowatt hour, less than what was once the case, but still too expensive to be competitive on the market, and it's not coming down to a reasonable level anytime soon. But the costs, however large, of these new ways of providing energy so as not to exacerbate the climate crisis are infinitely less than the cost of maintaining the status quo. That cost is an uninhabitable planet.
Sounds like a pretty high cost to me.
Yes, it is.
Over the past 50 years, cities have sold off publicly owned utilities to private for-profit businesses under the guidance of public-private partnerships, quote-unquote partnerships. This was done as cities were starved of tax revenues in the process of development, again, quote-unquote development, and in the process of gentrification. The results of these processes has, of course, been growing inequality, economic injustice, and a rush to the bottom. Infrastructure deteriorated. It has not been upgraded, nor have new technological advances been implemented. It is a failure of real estate capitalism, where developers rule our built environments for profit and livability for the elites. It seems that for all the energy and money the federal government is devoting to the achievement of cheap energy storage, its commitment seems to be limited to helping the private sector solve the problem, instead of itself taking charge with all of its resources and planning capacity. We believe it could do this by, for example, subsidizing the most viable method, or, heaven forbid, by nationalizing the utilities. In short, government intervention seems inevitable in the long run, and one might well speculate as to what kind of government would possess the political courage to carry out such an intervention. It looks like not the one we have now.
Not at all. You know, The Dixie Fire is now the largest single fire in California history. It has burned through a 500,000 acres so far, and it's only partially contained at the moment. In terms of size, it has surpassed the Mendocino complex that burned 459,123 acres across Mendocino, Lake, Glen, and Colusa counties in July of 2018. Now, the Dixie Fire has burned for almost a month and has devastated small surrounding communities in its path. Now, like with a number of recent fires here in Northern California, Pacific Gas and Electric Company, or PG&E as we like to call it here, appears to be the culprit, and the company is being called to account by a U.S. District Court judge who once said, quote, PG&E has been a terror, T-E-R-R-O-R, to the people of California, end quote. He actually spelled it out. And given the combination of its negligence and the climate-driven mega-drought conditions Californians are living through now, the company can rightly be called an existential threat to the people of Northern California. PG&E has fallen under criminal investigations for starting new big wildfires every year since the company burned down the town of Paradise in 2018. Alexandra Nagy, who is Food and Water Watch's California director, really nails on the head the problem with PG&E. Commenting on the Dixie Fire, Nagy states that, quote, while our climate warms and our drought worsens, we cannot afford any more mismanagement from PG&E that leads to catastrophic wildfires like the Dixie Fire. Investor-owned utilities like PG&E are motivated by profit, not by the public good, and have zero incentive to transition to safer, climate-friendly energy infrastructure like local solar or battery storage. We definitely mean solar. She says it's time for an equitable energy transition that leaves no one out and protects all communities from PG&E's mismanagement. It's time for energy democracy. We call on the California Public Utilities Commission to hold PG&E accountable and begin the process of giving control of their energy decisions back to California's communities, end quote. Yes, it's time for energy democracy.
So PG&E, are they going out there with torches and starting the fires themselves, or is it their mismanagement, gross, preventable, foreseeable mismanagement that's creating these fires?
Probably both, but actually the latter is the problem.
It strikes me, I mean, sorry for the ad lib, but it strikes me a little bit like what some people are saying about police departments, these unaccountable groups that seem far removed from actual local democratic control. And the utilities are functioning in the same kind of way, both Absolutely. With destructive consequences on their communities.
Absolutely. And PG&E has been a problem for years, at least since I've been out here in California.
Much of the news about this Dixie Fire rightly focuses on the devastation that the small surrounding communities suffer. Communities like Greenville, for example. The fire razed this town and has destroyed over 91 buildings. People are missing, and it is our hope that no one has lost his or her life. But of course, it's possible. As we think about this devastation, it's important that we include in our concern what's happening as well to other sentient beings, other than humans. During the news coverage of last month's Pacific Northwest record heat wave, you might have heard that more than 1 billion marine animals likely died from that heat wave. The water got too hot for these animals to survive the heat wave. You might have seen viral video taken of salmon injured by the rising temperatures of the Columbia and Snake Rivers. Sores all over their bodies.
All over their bodies.
Turning our attention to the Dixie Fire and other fires that are engulfing the West, according to naturalist William Simpson, quote, it is estimated that 20 to 80 animals per acre are killed in wildfires, end quote. And Elise, you said a moment ago, it's about 500,000 acres that have burned so
Absolutely.
Far. And the fire is still burning. So that's a lot of
animals. A lot of animals.
That's a lot of death. Simpson goes on to say that, quote, the impact of failed wildfire prevention on the flora and fauna is sending even more species of flora and fauna into the category of being endangered and threatened species, while some may even become extinct, end quote. So PG&E is also a terror and an existential threat to the animals, the flora, and the fauna. Yes, it's time for energy democracy, an energy democracy that protects and honors all life.
Can you imagine if the judge had said it's a terror to fauna and flora as well? That would be amazing. Anyway, finally, in their reporting on the Dixie Fire, news outlets have glommed onto the fact that the town of Greenville, which has suffered terrible devastation, is an historic town that dates back to California's Gold Rush era and has some structures more than a century old.
Tell us about the history, Elise.
Well, prior to the Gold Rush, let's be clear. The area now known as Greenville was a place the Maidu people called home, an indigenous tribe of hunters and gatherers who groomed their gathering grounds using fire as their primary tool for this purpose. Now, like many indigenous peoples of what we call California, the Maidu were displaced and overrun by white settlers who came searching for gold and who were armed with the deadly belief of manifest destiny. According to AAANativeArts.com, quote, between 1851 and 1852, 18 treaties were negotiated between the United States government and more than 100 California Indian tribes and bands. The treaties called for reservations of more than 8 million acres for the tribes. However, on July 8, 1852, the United States Senate secretly rejected the treaties, and from 1852 to 1854, Indian tribes were forcibly removed to temporary reservations. In the early 1900s, a researcher discovered the unratified treaties, and reformers petitioned Congress to appropriate money to provide land for the homeless Native Americans of California. Congress appropriated the money to purchase 9,000 acres, as opposed to 9 million, of land that became 50 separate rancherias, end quote. You are listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. This week we are talking about a range of topics, energy storage, the Dixie Fire, and other climate crisis news.
So one of these rancherias, which was approved by Congress for appropriation, was the Greenville Rancheria, the Rancheria of the Maidu tribe. And to bring it back home, Greenville is the town that just burned to the ground. AAANativeArts.com goes on to say that, quote, originally the small pieces of land or ranches were intended to provide housing for homeless and landless adult Indians. It was not intended to be reservations for separate tribal governments. Instead of getting their own reservations, some Indian nations were splintered into tiny postage stamp bands that lumped together Indians from different tribes, end quote. In 1953, Congress passed the California Rancheria Act, legislation that called for the termination of federal trusteeship for indigenous peoples in California. AAANativeArts.com goes on to indicate that, quote, 38 tribes were terminated in California, and tribal members were encouraged to sign away their official status in efforts to assimilate Indians into mainstream society, end quote. On its website, the Greenville Rancheria today notes that, quote, the Maidu people of Greenville Rancheria were almost completely destroyed, end quote, as a result of the California Rancheria Act. The tribe dispersed and now constitutes, quote, many subgroups or bands who live and identify with separate valleys, foothills, and mountains in northeastern central California, end quote. Tribes challenged the California Rancheria Act. As a result, in 1973, Congress passed the Indian Self-Determination and Education Act, which allowed, quote, tribes and rancherias to regain federal recognition. So the Maidu regained federal recognition and the original boundaries were restored. In 1988, the Maidu formally elected its first tribal council. The tribe operates medical clinics, providing health care to tribal members and low-income residents around the area, unquote. Since the COVID outbreak, the tribe's medical clinics have been providing COVID testing and services to residents in the area. Last week, Greenville Rancheria health and tribal officers were destroyed by the Dixie Fire.
The past month has seen so many floods and fires all around the world that we can't keep up with discussing them. Every time I opened my international news feed, it was a new place in the world that was flooding or having wildfires. Central Europe was inundated, literally. Germany got the worst of it in most of the headlines. More than 170 people died in July in Germany when rain fell heavily for days and rivers overran their banks and demolished town after town. The same extraordinary rainfall hit Belgium, where 8 people died, in Switzerland and the Netherlands and Luxembourg. All those countries had evacuations. In Limburg province in the Netherlands, from the photos, it looks like people piled into a dumpster that was equipped with flotation devices, and it was pulled by a vehicle with very tall tires, pulled through the flooded streets to higher ground. You see bizarre images of like 8 to 10 cars all stacked up because the currents of the water pushed them all to the same spot and then pushed them against each other. So the front of one car wedges under the back tires of the car in front of it, and they all stack on, you know, angles like a fan or a seashell. Those car pileups are some of the first places that rescue workers check, according to quotes I saw in some of the coverage. And oftentimes the people got out of the car, but sometimes they're trapped in there, hopefully still alive. The scale of the flooding was just huge. Both the German and Belgian armies were deployed. Austria and France both sent rescue workers to help. Entire neighborhoods of towns in Germany are just wiped off the map. It's too early to know what will be rebuilt and what won't.
To the east of all this inundation, there's extreme heat in North Macedonia, which is north of Greece. They declared a state of emergency over their fires. And, of course, Greece itself, where it's more than 110 degrees Fahrenheit and wildfires are coming perilously close to Athens. The scale of the Greek fires are said to be unprecedented. As we record this in early August, they are not controlled. The Greek army has been deployed. Romania and several other nations are sending firefighters to try to contain those fires, and there are mass evacuations going on. Local reports are saying that virtually every structure on the island of Evia is damaged or destroyed. There is risk of fire on Crete as well. It's a huge part of the country that's either on fire or at risk of soon being on fire. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis says, quote, "If some people still doubt if climate change is real, let them come and see the intensity of phenomena here," unquote. East of that, they're having wildfires in Turkey as well. BBC says it's over 130 separate fires along the Mediterranean and Aegean coasts of Turkey as of the end of July. And this is a lot. It's usually far smaller and slower than this in both Greece and Turkey. Yes, they do have occasional wildfires, but never before on this kind of scale. Residents and tourists are being evacuated. But the Turkish resources are proving inadequate to put the fires out, so neighboring countries are helping too. Iran sent planes to drop water. It's ironic that Iran, which has a drought, is dropping water in Turkey, but that's the world we're in.
Yes, it is.
Russia sent planes. Azerbaijan sent planes. Croatia sent at least one plane. Ukraine sent planes. It's like a regional mobilization to deal with this situation. It's a bad situation, of course, very bad situation. But it's nevertheless nice to see Ukraine and Russia collaborating on something. I mean, these countries have been fighting militarily in recent years, and so at least they're working together here. So it's not just Greece and Turkey and Greenville in huge parts of California that are on fire. Sardinia, which is a large island in the Mediterranean that's part of Italy, has seen bad wildfires. By July 27th, Italy declared a state of emergency and asked for assistance from the European Union. And 1,000 people were evacuated from Sardinia. At the same time, southern Spain, the Catalonia region, has a large wildfire that authorities are struggling to get under control.
My, oh my. So from Spain in the west to Turkey in the east, from Italian islands in the Mediterranean Sea up north through Switzerland and Germany all the way to the Netherlands, it seems almost like all of Europe is either on fire or underwater. These are not normal fires, and they're not normal floods. Every news article seems to have a similar quote from a longtime senior citizen resident saying how they've never seen anything like this and never heard of anything on this scale. Afghanistan, too, has heavy flooding in Nuristan province in the eastern part of the country near the border with Pakistan. Currently, that area is under Taliban control. The rains don't care what religion you are. Whose military occupies which province is looking less and less important when the flooding is everywhere. Mudslides buried entire houses, according to a BBC report. And Taliban reported 150 people died, and they say that death toll could go higher. If you're wondering if this is climate change, yeah, it's climate change. I doubt there are any climatologists arguing that it is not. Warmer air makes more water evaporate. So when it's hotter, there's more water in the clouds, and it comes down as more rain. It's the same reason everything gets dry when it's hot. More water is evaporating. So the hotter it gets, the larger the rainfall. The larger the rainfall, the more flooding. In the scheme of atmospheric chemistry, this is one of the easiest things. This is not one of the complicated things. Hotter air means more water evaporation. So when it's not raining, things get very, very dry and fires happen. When it is raining, it rains buckets and everything floods. That's what's happening.
Yeah, you get these huge imbalances in extreme dryness in one place and extreme flooding in another place that didn't used to happen kind of scale because of that situation where hotter weather makes more evaporation. That's the core explanation. As bad as Europe is getting it, India and China seem to be getting it as bad, maybe even worse. In India, there were torrential rains in Mumbai from around July 19th to 24th. Just devastating rains. At least 149 people were killed. That's a similar death toll to Germany and a similar death toll to Afghanistan. Huge numbers had to evacuate. In the hard-hit city of Sangli, 169,000 people were evacuated from that city alone. Flooding spread all around Maharashtra state, which is the state around Mumbai in the western part of India. And then it spread to the state of Goa, which borders Maharashtra. And these are big states, especially Maharashtra. If you look at a map, it's only a slight exaggeration to say that most of western India was underwater.
That's amazing.
Then in Henan province, China, which is inland west of China, and north of Wuhan, at least 200,000 people were evacuated from flooding. 302 people died. The scale of this is huge. I read that over 13 million people were, quote, affected, unquote. And I admit I don't know what's contained in that word affected. But it does convey that this was a very large city and surrounding area that flooded. 13 million people affected. Mm-hmm. China, of course, is a well-networked and high-technological place, so you get a lot of social media, videos, and reports. Railway tunnels flooded, and 500 people had to be rescued from them. And because of these social media reports, we have a little bit of detail. These people on the train were watching the water come in over their belts and climbing up their bellies and torsos, almost to their shoulders, people calling their loved ones to say goodbye, people handing their babies to the tallest people in the train car. That situation was evacuated in time, so those particular folks survived, but not everyone was so lucky. When we hear about huge numbers in huge regions, we can lose track of the humans, the individual humans involved. And I hope I can read this one without getting too emotional. In the flooding in Henan, China, rescue workers saw this happen. A young mother with a four-month-old baby girl was watching a mudslide and a flood cascading right for her home. Mm. She held on to her baby as long as she could, but there was a higher place that she could see from her window. And just as the mudslide reached her, she flung her baby into the air toward that higher place. Mm. Yeah. The baby survived without serious injury. The mudslide went under the higher place where the baby landed. The mother died, drowned in mud. She was later dug out by rescue workers, and her body was in the mud in the position of throwing the baby, full body extension, arms above her head. She did it just in time, probably 1 second or so before she was covered, based on the position that she was found in. It worked what she did. She can't know it, but she succeeded in what she was trying to do. The desperate attempt to save that little girl's life was, in fact, a success. We're going to see that very scene of desperation for survival happen over and over again, like a looping video that we can't turn off. We want to hit pause, and we want to hit stop, and we can't do it, like a broken remote control, so it keeps happening. The heat will continue to evaporate more water, that will continue to come down as torrential rains, that will continue to wash away cars, homes, animals, and human bodies. And mothers will continue to have to throw their children as far as they can as the mudslides and floodwaters bear down on them. This is Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. You are listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. This week, we're talking about a range of topics: energy storage, the Dixie Fire, flooding throughout the world, and other climate crisis news.
Wow, Matt, that's just unimaginable. Wow.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding its next meeting on Wednesday, August 11th at 7 p.m. You are invited to attend the meeting. It will be held through the Zoom remote meeting service. The fastest and easiest way to join the board meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website, WBAI.org. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. 929-205-6099 and enter this meeting ID 922-457-2995. 922-457-2995. And as if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, 99.5. So it's 995-995-99. The LSB is looking forward to sharing with you how the station, which has been navigating the challenges posed by COVID, will navigate into the future again. That's Wednesday, August 11th at 7 p.m. Hope to see you.
The next Community Advisory Board meeting will be held on Sunday, August 15th, 2021 at 1 p.m. The meeting will be held on Zoom and by phone. For contact information, go to the CAB page, that's Community Advisory Board page at WBAI.org, or to KPFTX.org. The board reviews the programming schedule, budgets, and assists with long-term plans for the station. The CAB is made up of listeners to WBAI who donate their time. Meetings are open to the public. And once again, the next Community Advisory Board meeting will be held Sunday, August 15th, 2021 at 1 p.m. on Zoom. To connect, find information on the CAB page on WBAI.org or KPFTX.org. Everyone is welcome to attend the meetings. Hope you can attend.
$0.33 a day. Not much, is it? Loose change. A third of a cup of coffee. It's nothing. But did you know that 33 cents a day can help WBAI stay on the air? That's all it takes. As little as 33 cents a day, $10 a month, you can be a BAI buddy. A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a recurring monthly donation to WBAI using either a credit card, debit card, or by electronic fund transfer from your bank account. It's safe, secure, and easy, and it helps keep our unique, alternative, and diverse programming on the air. You'll get a WBAI membership card and other goodies. Sign up online. Go to WBAI.org and click on donate. All the details are right there. The WBAI buddy. Be one today.